News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, it's Computers in You. We welcome back to the program science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. Greg also writes a couple of columns for the newspaper about computing. They run on Mondays in the circuit section of the paper. One is a question and answer column, the other a column featuring interesting websites. That column is called Links. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Thanks, Celeste. It's good to be here.
Good to see you. And we've already got some callers ready to go.
All right.
So let's go first to a listener on line four on the toll-free line. No, excuse me, line one.
Okay. I have a Windows XP Pro with the Office programs acquired in spring of 2002, and I have a question about the way Word works.
All right.
My wife and I both have accounts on the computer, and when we use Netscape, we can customize it to suit ourselves, and we each get our own version.
Right.
But when using Word, it seems that when you make any of the customizing changes, they are effective everywhere. And I was wondering if there's any way around that.
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure how to answer it, sir. So what you want to do is you each want to have individual settings in Word. And then you want that to take, like, when she signs in on her account in Windows or you sign in on your account in Windows.
Right.
Right. I'm not sure that I'm not entirely certain that Word will do that. You know, there are some programs that are not networkable, so to speak, which you're not really on a network, but you've got multiple users. They're not meant for multiple users in that way. And I'm not entirely certain that. I think it might depend on what version of Word you have. I think if you have, you know, the version that is with the full Office package, you know, like the Office Pro package, then that might be the case. But I'm not sure if you've got like the home Word package, so to speak, whether it would be. Did it come with a computer?
Pardon?
Did it come with the computer?
Yes, although it was packed on it for us.
And
so, it didn't come like from.
Yeah,
a normal retail channel.
Is it part of? Is it Word as part of the Office suite, or is it Word as part of the Works suite that they sometimes put on computers?
I don't know.
I bet it's my guess on this, and this is something I'll look up and talk about in my column if I find a good answer.
Great.
My guess in this would be that it's probably part of the consumer-oriented work suite that Microsoft and a lot of computer companies bundle, as opposed to the full, big Office suite. And my guess would be that it's not a multiple-user version in that case.
Okay. I tried to look around in the program itself to see if I could find anything that would tell me about that. And wasn't successful. Are there any instructions that you could provide that might help me try to track it down?
Did you say you looked in the help files?
Mm-hmm.
And did you try something like multiple users or something like that to see if there's anything about that in there? Or
I tried whatever I could think of and wasn't able to find anything that was helpful. But I thought you might. Have some advice on that, but I guess the thing I'll do is I'll just wait and track your column.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yeah, and I'll take a closer look at that and see if I can come up with a more definitive answer. But my guess would be that, you know, some programs are not made to be multi-user programs. My guess would be that this is a case, it's a consumer version of Word that's probably bundled with the Work Suite, and it doesn't have that multi-user functionality that you would get if you bought, you know, the full Office Suite.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks much.
But I'll look it up and see if I can find a better answer.
Great.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener on line two. Good afternoon.
Oh, hi there. I'm sorry. I've got a question about my email program. I'm using Outlook Express.
Yes.
And I wouldn't mind switching to something else. And what I'd like to do is find something that would allow me to, well, Outlook Express has got this function, block sender, so I can try as I might to block some of the people that send me spam, but you know, they're always coming from different addresses. I do notice that some of them, there's some foreign countries that seem to send a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of them from, and then there's also several, I guess it's domain names, like there's one moosq.com,
mm-hmm.
and I get quite a few from them. I wondered, haven't been able to figure out any way in Outlook Express, and it's just kind of a basic thing, to block something like star.moosq.com, like
mm-hmm.
block all that, or block everything from Germany, or everything
mm-hmm.
from whatever GT is, whatever country that is. Do you have any recommendations for some other email program that I might use that's a good one, just a general good one that might have better blocking capabilities?
Yeah, so you want something that's got some built-in spam filtering capabilities,
well,
right?
I guess. I mean, I've tried, when I was using Hotmail one time, I tried some of that spam filtering where it's supposedly looking for something that identifies it as spam, and I ended up having messages that people were actually sending to me that I wanted were blocked out, and the spam got through.
Mm-hmm.
I've never trusted that very much. But
well,
maybe that's what I need to do.
I'll give you a couple of suggestions.
Okay.
You know, there are things that you can add to. Now, Outlook Express really doesn't it doesn't have any built-in automatic, I guess I'll say, spam filtering per se.
Yeah.
You can go in and set up rules, mail rules. Okay. If you do you know what version of? Well, I don't think it matters the version. If you go to tools.
Yeah.
And you go to message rules and then select mail, you'll get the dialog box for setting up rules.
Okay.
So you could set up you know, rules here that say, let's say the from line contains certain words, or the subject line contains certain words, and you could tell it to delete that or to move it to a junk folder that you set up, or something of that nature.
Right.
Okay. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that trying to set up those rules for all of the spam that you get can be a nightmarish, time-consuming, and probably losing battle, okay?
That's probably right. Yeah.
So you're looking more for something that will do some filtering for you, some automated filtering.
That'd be nice if
right.
there is something. I've looked at – they have some – I've been at a big box store where they sold boxed
mm-hmm.
Spam protection things, but – I kind of tried to read what it had to say and on the instructions on it, and it didn't impress me much, but maybe
right.
that does work.
Well, really you have a couple of choices there. Outlook Express obviously doesn't have that built in, so what you need to do is get something that works in conjunction with Outlook Express, like Spam Killer. That's a product that's sold by McAfee, the folks that also do virus protection software, or Choice Mail, which is, I recall, is free. That's something like that also. And,
okay.
and what they do is they kind of act like email clients that work before you work Outlook Express, and they intercept that spam and do what you tell them to with it either delete it. They can delete it automatically, for example, or move it to a junk folder
okay.
that you set up.
All right. Well, I'll try looking for that choice mail or spam killer.
Right.
And then
you might think, you know, maybe you want to think about alternative email clients too, although since you've got Outlook Express sitting there and you're used to it.
Well, I know that it's prone to viruses more than some other ones, so I wouldn't be opposed to.
Well, it's the big target.
Using maybe Eudora is just as big a target or.
Eudora is a pretty big target, also probably not as big as Outlook Express. You know, there are now a couple of. Freeware options that are from the Mozilla project that also does some browsers and, in fact, is doing the Netscape-style browser now.
I've actually tried to download that Mozilla one, and I don't know what I've done wrong, but I haven't been able to find it or use it once I thought I downloaded it.
Make sure you're getting the right version because they make that for multiple operating systems,
okay.
and you want to make sure you're getting
one you recommend?
I think that's worth looking at. The other thing I think that's worth looking at is now Mozilla, which used to be the Netscape browser basically, and now is an open source project that volunteers are essentially working on and keep improving. It is an integrative package that has a browser. It's got an email client. It's also got a news reading client if you want to do that. Okay, so you get a big package there. What they've also done is break those pieces apart. So that they've now got a nice browser called Firefox that I'm partial to that's just a browser and are working on an email client called Thunderbird that looks promising to me.
Okay.
So you might look at something like that. You might consider Eudora or look at some of the other email clients that are out there that, as alternatives. The problem is... the Mozilla pieces are all free, but a lot of the others are not. So
right.
you may end up paying where Outlook Express, you didn't have any cost for that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the information.
All right.
Bye.
Okay. Good luck. Next, we talk with a listener on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I run a laptop using Windows 98 Second Edition, and my question is how to stop what's really an annoyance. Namely, that often when I attempt to shut down my ISP connection, it refuses to do so. It'll dial back and try and remake the connection without me wanting it to. A little bit more background. I've contacted the ISP, and they've pretty much assured me that it's nothing to do with their software that is causing it. I use an alternate email client that's associated with the contact program ACT.
Uh-huh.
And just a normal browsing. I sort of think that it's when I've been using ACT that I'm unable to cleanly stop the connection. And so I investigated that possibility by hitting Control-Alt-Delete after I had closed out of the email module of the ACT program, and when I look at the list of what programs are running, even though that program seemingly isn't running, I still see ACT email listed as one of the ones I could end task.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, can you take a guess at what's causing... The unwanted attempt to reestablish the dial-up connection.
So what happens is you want to close out your dial-up connection.
Right.
And you do so, and then all of a sudden it starts right back up, reconnects.
It starts right back up. If I hit cancel, I can, it's a couple more little while waiting and a couple clicks, and eventually it'll shut down for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, this would be my guess at this, my best guess at this point. You've got a setting in that email client you're using to automatically connect and check for email somewhere in that email client, and that's what it's doing. So
okay.
this doesn't happen all the time, right? Does this happen every time?
Pretty frequently, and yeah. I've hunted within the ACT program settings and preferences and so forth and so on,
mm-hmm.
looking for exactly what you took the guess at, and
mm-hmm.
I can't seem to find it. They have once you're using the email program, there's a preference you can check that seems to only work for that, for the duration of that session,
mm-hmm.
where you can say you want to work offline.
Mm-hmm.
But the next time you start up that email module, your instruction to work offline doesn't seem to continue. If you start it from scratch, no matter whether you've checked the work offline box or not,
mm-hmm.
first thing it does is tries to make a connection and retrieve your email for you.
Okay. Now, have you got a have you looked at your Windows dial-up connection settings?
No. If you want to tell me, then I'll do that.
Yeah. Go into your control panel and look up those dial-up connection settings, and.
Uh-huh.
And you should find there should be a checkbox somewhere in the various tabs of those settings that says automatically connect to the internet when a program wants you to.
Uh-huh.
And if you uncheck that checkbox, I think you may that box may be checked and you may be able to uncheck it and solve your problem.
Okay, could I ask another quick, totally unrelated computer question?
Okay,
sure.
I'm just about at the point of needing to replace my computer, and if I buy a new modern one, I'll try and get quite a bit of power to it because I try to make these things last 3 years, which is almost an impossibility. I see that one of the major options in buying a new one, it strikes me, is whether to get XP Home or XP Professional. I'm not networked to anybody as I'm a one-man business. Is there, nonetheless, it's been recommended for reasons that I don't grasp that XP Professional would be a wiser choice.
Uh-huh.
Do you have an opinion there? Is there a reason why I would insist on XP Pro if the computer which I'd otherwise select to buy happens to come with XP Home?
You're not going to make a network.
I haven't and can't foresee that I necessarily would.
Well, there are two big advantages to XP Pro. One is some of the networking tools in there, the tools for setting up a network. And then
uh-huh.
there are some machine administrative tools that I think are better in XP Pro than in XP Home. But if you're not going to be setting up a network, particularly, you're not going to be setting up, a network with several computers on it as opposed to just a couple. And you're not the kind of person who really wants to get, down underneath the hood and play with the valves and pistons and all that kind of stuff. I don't think you need to worry about it.
Going off what you just said, I have thought that since it's worthless as a trade-in or trying to sell it, I might keep my little mini sub-notebook computer just for the occasional trip, and the new computer would be a desktop. I guess I would want to form a miniature network between the two of them for the
uh-huh.
point of synchronizing stuff. Would that miniature network in and of itself be enough to warrant getting the XP Pro?
It might be depending on how much it was going to cost you. Now you're talking about buying a machine that's got XP Home in it and going and buying a boxed upgrade to XP Pro.
Well, no, I think the places where I would buy,
you've got a choice
up front. You've got a choice, but it appears that the choice to go with XP Pro does cost money.
Yes, it does. It might be worth it to you. But
okay.
I don't know, it depends on, I guess, on how you judge money, if I was going to be doing what you're doing, okay, and I'm talking about just wanting to connect my laptop to my desktop,
uh-huh.
To trade files back and forth, I don't know that it was going to cost me, let's say, $100 to get XP Pro, which is what I often see when I'm pricing computers and they come with XP Home and you want to upgrade to XP Pro, I often see a price of $100. I think you can do it for less than that, but that let's use that as a as an example price. If it was going to cost me $100 and all I was going to be doing was connecting my desktop and my laptop, I probably wouldn't spend the $100. I'd probably find a better way to spend that $100.
Okay.
So, and you know, the other thing, though, is there are do you connect to other in your business, do you connect into like a company network or anything like that?
I don't foresee that I'd be doing it.
Okay,
but,
okay.
The other thing, you mentioned that the second major reason to go to XP Pro was maintenance type stuff. Does any? I am, even though I'm a tiny business and don't have that much data, I've become, based on a series of negative experiences, kind of a freak about backup.
Uh-huh.
Does the XP Pro offer significant additional tools or automation for backup?
I don't think that's a problem either. If you want to, you should probably, in any event, get a dedicated backup piece of backup software, something like Retrospect or something like that, which will have far more options for you than the simple backup software they include in Windows.
With regard to backup, what kind of hardware would you go with? Do you think it's essential for a small amount of data to go to tape if you're really serious about keeping that data, or are there other media that are better nowadays?
Well, what I'm telling people these days, and you're a little different because you're talking about a home business, but what I'm telling people at home these days about backup is just get a hard drive. That's another hard drive that's the same size. The price of hard drives, you know, is dirt cheap anymore. What I've done is I've just got a hard drive that's the same size as my, my full-time internal hard drive. Mine happens to be external. It could be internal. You could put another drive in your computer. And, what I do is I periodically, use, ghosting or snapshot software to take a complete copy of my, hard drive. Then if I have a problem, which I did earlier this year, I had a hard drive that went bad. I've got a complete copy of my hard drive on another drive, and I just use that software to reverse the process and put it on a new drive. One fell swoop.
Okay, I hope that helps. I've got a number of other callers waiting, so let's go and take our next call. Caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
This is just a real quick comment going back to the caller before this one who was concerned about spam filtering on his email software. There was another third-party package he might want to look into. I just ran into it called PocoMail, P-O-C-O-M-A-I-L. And it seems to be built specifically to avoid getting viruses that Outlook Express is susceptible to and better spam filtering. So that's
good.
All I had to say.
Well, thanks for the tip. Let's talk with another listener, line four. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Enjoy the program. Some time back, I had the opportunity to download a program called SpyBot.
Uh-huh.
I was made aware of it from what I thought was like a trusted source. And I guess it's supposed you can use it to go in and clean up your computer and take off things that may be used to transmit messages to other places. Well, then I heard that there are some of these things out there are like Trojan horses, and that they actually do send your information off. Do you have any comment on SpyBot or what to stay away from or what to use?
So you're wanting to know whether SpyBot is safe or not?
Yes.
Yes, SpyBot is safe. And as long as you get it at you know, the right place from SpyBot, and the web address for that would be www.safer-networking.org, okay?
Okay. Well, I was made aware of it on a source, you know, an internet connection that I've used a number of times. I can't remember if it was Smart Money Source or something, but I thought it was a trusted source.
Yeah.
Advertised on there. Somehow I was made aware of it quite some time ago. And I just wanted to be sure that it wasn't some kind of a Trojan horse.
No. No, in fact, it's a very good program for finding and getting rid of what we call spyware or adware, things that keep track of what you do on your computer and get ads shipped to you and that kind of thing.
Another thing I do, I never ask my computer to save my passwords.
Right.
You know, that little box pops off. Do you want it to remember the passwords? And I always check no,
mm-hmm.
because I think that's just an extra measure of safety to keep things off there.
Right, it is. You're balancing risk versus convenience there. Although I think if you're the only one who uses your computer, you otherwise practice good internet connection habits, like having an antivirus software and having a firewall and that kind of thing. You're probably not exposing yourself very much.
Yeah, I'm still just have the old fashioned telephone connection.
Yeah,
and
you're not
as soon as
exposed.
I get done, I disconnect.
Yeah, yeah, in that case, you're pretty well protected there.
Well, that's good. Okay, I thought with having the computer save the passwords, that maybe there was some way that some hacker could get into there and retrieve those passwords that were saved in the computer. But maybe that's pretty hard to do, too.
Well, it can be done. But, with a dial-up connection like yours where you're not constantly exposed there, it's highly unlikely.
Okay. Good questions, though, and good things to think about as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go and talk with another listener. Caller on, I believe we're going to go to a line one. Very good. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to ask you about a remark that was made by recently by Mark Haynes on CNBC's Squawk Box. I don't know if you're familiar with the program or not. It's business news.
All right.
They were discussing the market performance, past and probable future of a company that markets virus protections. And Mr. Haynes said, sound exact words maybe, but close. He said, the big secret is that these viruses don't affect Apple computers. Was he correct in that?
well, yes, to an extent, okay? And the fact is that the vast majority of viruses are written to attack Windows systems and the Microsoft software contained therein, particularly Internet Explorer and Outlook Express and Outlook, the programs used to connect to the Internet, also Office. Now, why is that? Okay, is it because Microsoft writes really insecure software? Well, some people might argue that, okay? I think the biggest reason is that, Microsoft is a near monopoly that has something in excess of 90% of the market. So if you're a virus writer and, you either want to make money off of it by, collecting people's passwords and credit card numbers and all that kind of stuff, or you just want to, you're malicious and you just want to be a vandal, an Internet vandal, so to speak, what are you going to do? Are you going to pick Apple Macintosh systems or Linux, which have collectively less than 10% of the market out there, or are you going to pick on the big dog where you'll get the most bang for your buck? Right, you're going to pick on Microsoft. So yeah, it's literally true that the vast majority of these things affect Microsoft systems and do not affect Apple and Linux systems.
Well, now you say the vast majority. Would that mean that one would still need protective devices on an Apple?
Well, I'll tell you, I have both flavors at home, okay? I have a Windows machine and an Apple Mac OS X machine. I should say two of the three flavors because, I include Linux out there too as an option for people. Yeah, I have some protection on that machine. I run a firewall, so that people can't probe it because it's pretty much connected to the Internet all the time. I have antivirus software on it. I do some things periodically to check for other potential problems. But the you know, I'm overly cautious, I would say. I'd say it's always good to have a firewall. But the fact is there are no viruses in the wild out there floating around for Mac OS X operating system at this point.
Now, does that have anything to do with screening spam, or does that get through on the Apple?
Well, it does. Some of it does get through. The email client mail that Apple includes with OS X has a nice automatic spam filtering system that I think does a pretty good job. But yes, some spam does get through. So you still see, you know, those goofy email messages with random words and ads for Viagra and all of that kind of thing. The operative point, though, is that although that spam may get through, any viruses attached to it are at this point only effective on Windows systems, and will not, although they'll get through, they will not run on your Mac OS X system.
Oh, okay. Now, if these viruses won't run, will browsers operate on the Apple?
Sure, you've got the full suite of browsers and more available for OS X and Linux machines that you have.
So you'd buy a Type 4 of that machine.
Well, you wouldn't even have to buy it. There are plenty of Apple gives away a free browser called Safari. There are plenty of free browsers for Linux, including Mozilla and Firefox, which I mentioned earlier. There's even a version of Internet Explorer, Microsoft Internet Explorer, for OS X machines. I'm sure there is no version of Internet Explorer for Linux, but that's okay because there are plenty of other options.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 2. Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi. Is this me?
Yep, go ahead.
I have a laptop gateway that has both Windows 2000 Professional and Windows 2000 Server on it. I've had problems with the Windows 2000 very regularly freezing up at some point after I start to use it, and then a difficulty getting it to reboot. And I also had a recommendation to use a Windows XP Home Upgrade Disk to do what I think is called a fresh install on that, which is basically, as I understand it, some like a low-level reformatting of the hard drive. And it occurs to me two questions about that. Is Windows 2000, I mean, how does that relate to Windows XP Home? You cannot use the upgrade disk with Windows 2000. You can with Windows 98 and ME, but not with 2000. Is there enough of a benefit that I might get as a relatively unsophisticated user from going through the hassle of doing that fresh upgrade to get to Windows XP Home, or whether I'd be better off trying to see if I can fix Windows 2000?
Yeah. Now, can I ask why you have two versions of Windows 2000 on there?
That's a good question. I was going to mention that, and I thought, well, it's probably not relevant. But at any rate, I bought it from my son, who works in the IP area, and that was what he used and had on there. But since it gives you the choice of which one you want to load when you start it up, I just ignore the server and go with the Pro. And also, when you're thinking about that, I thought, well, hey, this is not a problem. I'll just go back and I'll delete or uninstall at least the server. But apparently that's not as easy as I thought it was when you go to the add delete programs menu.
Right.
That you can't really do that in what seemed to me to be a very handy fashion, which made me think I better not try it then.
No, yeah. Now, do you have the disk for Windows 2000 Pro?
Yes.
So you have the installation CD, and you could just reinstall that.
That's a possibility. Yes.
Do you have you already bought an XP disk?
No. As a matter of fact, the reason I was thinking about going that route is that I happen to have a legitimate XP Home upgrade that I was going to use on an earlier machine I had,
yeah.
But I decided just to get rid of it. I bought a new Dell laptop. Desktop machine, which of course came with Windows XP Home on it already. So I didn't need the the upgrade CD, so I can use it legitimately for the laptop.
You said it wouldn't upgrade it.
Well, the instructions say, and on Microsoft's site and in the little owner's manual that comes with the CD.
Yeah.
So you can use it to upgrade from 98 and ME, but you cannot upgrade to Windows XP Home from Windows 2000. You can upgrade, but you have to use Windows XP Professional.
Right. Use
XP Pro. I don't want to throw away the $100 or what, I guess about 90 that I've got in that the XP Home upgrade just for that.
Right. So really, you can't use your XP upgrade disk to upgrade the machine this laptop that we're talking about.
Well, if you can do it, but what it amounts to is you have to treat the machine as though it has no operating system on it.
Oh, okay.
So it basically, as I understand this, it's kind of reformats the hard drive, so you lose all of your, of course, the application software is not a problem because I've got the installation disks for those, but
yeah.
Any of the files that have resulted from the use of the application software is all.
I lost him.
Yeah, we lost him. I don't know what happened there, but from what we know.
Should be listening, and I think I formulated an answer here. Yeah, I think you'd probably benefit from, saving, backing up the documents that you want to save, the stuff you've created, and cleaning off the hard drive in that laptop. And reinstalling either Windows 2000 Pro, get rid of the server version, or installing, if it's possible, from that upgrade disk, which evidently you've checked, and it is installing Windows XP. You said you wouldn't classify yourself as the most experienced computer user in the world, so I'd suggest Windows XP. Which has a lot of advantages to it as far as usability compared to the classic setup of Windows 2000 and down.
Okay. Let's talk with another caller. Line 1, good afternoon.
I have been regularly deleting my cookies every day. I'm really shocked at how much I get in a day. Is this a good idea?
It's not that it's a bad idea. Again, it kind of depends. You're talking about convenience versus absolute security, right?
Yeah.
I'm not unlike yourself. I sometimes go into my browser settings and delete some cookies. Okay, but I also leave some in. There are certain newspaper websites and that kind of thing that I go to. Where those cookies are, storing my ID and sign-on information so I don't have to go through the whole thing of typing in my username and password every time.
Uh-huh.
And again, these are on my machines at home, which only I use, not someone else.
Uh-huh.
So I just leave those in there. A lot of the cookies that get tossed in there by, advertising companies and that kind of marketing companies and just random websites, I like to clean those out occasionally for security purposes and also for purposes of stability in my browsing programs.
Okay.
It's not a bad idea. It's not. It's probably, again, it's not one of those things that's absolutely essential in your setting at home.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Greg Klein of the News Gazette is with us this afternoon on our Computers in You program for the month. This is a program we do on the third Thursday of the month, every month. And we've got another caller already to talk with. So let's go, without any further ado, to Line 4, a listener on Line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. I have a computer question about scheduling programs. We are looking for a scheduling program for our office. We are a social service agency with
uh-huh.
multiple people. And we have Outlook calendars, but it's very awkward to use. And we've been looking at some of the medical places, but they all have all these billing things and stuff. Are there any good programs for that?
So you want a kind of a common calendar
That we can put people's like, you know, that would have actually columns for each person and that could schedule the people in, that we could, we'll be on network to be able to look at, you know, look in and see when we have someone, or if we have someone in our office, we can schedule them for a couple days mm-hmm. later, and it'll show up on the receptionist.
Okay, and you guys, do you run Windows?
Yes.
But you don't like the idea of Outlook, because that's kind of the
Well, we have the Outlook calendar, but it's not really a scheduling program.
Mm-hmm.
Something like a salon would use.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Or a doctor's office, except those most of those seem to have billing options and Medicare mm-hmm. stuff and all kinds of things that we wouldn't use.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had mentioned one, what was it called? Somebody was using Eclipse, like an Eclipse program, but they didn't like it, so we don't want that one.
Yeah, I know that the place I go to get my hair cut, they have a program like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then every stylist at the beginning of the day has a printout of their clients.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. And if Outlook could do that, we just haven't figured out how it can do
it.
Yeah,
I think they use a special program, but I don't have any idea what it is. Greg's doing a search here, kind of a Googling thing, I think.
Yeah, what I'm going to suggest, and I'm checking this right now to see that I'm not giving you bad information, but what I'm going to suggest is that you go to a software site called Two Cows. Do you know anything about that?
Two Cows?
Yeah.
No.
The address is www.tucows2cows.com.
Okay.
And it's you know, it's a big software archive, and when I typed in scheduling programs, I get 300 entries.
Oh.
So,
okay,
so there are probably some things on there that aren't so good, but I see some of them here are rated 5 cows. That's good.
Okay.
so you might...
like 2 cows is you could do searches for just about anything.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big software archive.
Okay.
And you know, they've got descriptions in there, and all of these generally they're either freeware or shareware. There's some commercial in here.
Okay.
Where they're either they don't cost you anything or they're not very expensive.
Oh,
and
like that.
Yeah, yeah. Being a social service agency, I imagine you would like that. So that's a good place to, you might take a look at what's in there and see if there's something you think would meet your needs.
Great. Thanks very much.
All right.
Okay. Good
Bye-bye.
Luck. Bye-bye. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Greg Klein is our guest this afternoon. We just have about a minute and a half to spare here before we wrap things up. So I thought maybe no one's waiting for us on the phone. So I thought I would talk with you a little bit about a program, a feature we heard this morning and this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine from NPR's Chris Arnold about the energy that computers can waste. And so the EPA is saying, hey, folks, you can save some money and you can prevent pouring more greenhouse gas mm-hmm. into the atmosphere by putting your computer into a sleep mode or standby mode when you're not using it. That's
right.
The monitor, right?
Well, it's both the monitor
and the
computer. You'll find that you have a sleep or standby setting for your computer as well as your monitor. Now, I listened to that story. I thought it was a good story, and but one thought came to my mind immediately as I was doing that. And in fact, they mentioned some of this in the story. The problem is that it's kind of a shared problem between the computer companies and people, because on the one hand, a lot of people don't use the sleep and standby settings that are available in their computer. On the other hand, those sleep and standby settings often cause problems of various kinds, particularly lost network connections and that kind of thing. Sometimes you get at situations where depending on what your system setup is. The machine doesn't wake up, and you end up having to, you know, press the reset button or flick the power switch on and off to even get out of that. So I generally tell people that, you know, take your chances if you're going to put your computer on a sleep cycle. The monitor is a different thing entirely, however, and that is the piece of the system that really burns up the energy. It's not a bad idea at all to set your monitor to go off after a certain amount of time in activity. In Windows, for example, to do this, if you right-click on your desktop, the entry screen that you see when you boot up your computer, and you select Properties, and then you select the tab that says Screensaver, you'll see there down near the bottom of the dialog box that comes up an option that says Energy Saving Features of the Monitor. And if you press the button there that says Power, you can set it on a schedule. So you can tell it, okay, if there's been no activity on my computer for 20 minutes, shut the monitor down. Or if there's been no activity for an hour, shut the monitor down.
Mm-hmm.
That same kind of option exists in Mac OS X mm-hmm. systems. It's just generally a feature in computers these days. And that's not a bad idea at all.
Yeah.
That has no effect on, your system is still sitting there running. It's just not showing up on the screen because the monitor's shut down.
Yeah.
And you do save a lot of energy.
Yeah. Well, that's what I do on my desktop here at work because I'm in the studio so often.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I'm in the studio, if I'm not on the computer, the monitor goes to black.
And it's not a bad idea to have your computer go to sleep as well. I just like to tell people that that there are instances where that can create problems for you, dropping network connections, making it hard to pick them back up, or even causing you to have to hard reboot your computer.
Okay, very good. And a listener called in with a suggestion for the last caller who called us about the scheduling
mm-hmm.
thing. And the listener who called in to give us this tip suggests Schedule View. So Google Schedule View, I guess, would be the thing to do there. Greg, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
All right. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Greg Klein is the science and technology reporter for the News Gazette. He writes a couple of columns for the newspaper about computing. They run on Mondays in the circuits section of the paper. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the corn pit were lower. In the bean pit, the nearbys were down, but the deferred contracts, the new crop, were higher for the day. Let's begin with the wheat, though. July contract there was up just a half cent as pressure continues to come. Wheat beginning to be harvested across much of the Midwest and parts of the western areas of the nation. 356 the high, the low at 350, a settlement price at 352.5. That was up a half cent for the day. September contract 364.75, the high, the low at 358.5. A settlement price at 361.75, up 0.75. I was on the South Farms here on the campus yesterday taking a look at the wheat as the rain fell. And the folks who are responsible for harvesting said when she stops raining, we'll get her put in the bin. So we'll see how that happens. September, December contract now. 373.5, the high, the low at 367.5. A settlement price in the wheat pit at 371.75, up 1.25. By the way, it's the centennial year for the research farms out at the South Farms. 100 years of research happening there, August the 19th. You can join us for a big day when we'll celebrate that. Mark it on your calendars. 379, the high in the March wheat pit. 376.5, the low. And a settlement price at 379. It was up 2.25 for the day. From the corn pit, July contract, 283.25, high, low at 275.25. A settlement price at 277.75, down 3.75 for the day. September contract, 287.5, the high, the low at 279. And a settlement price at 281.25, down 3.75. Oster Dow Jones reporting that traders at the floor at the Board of Trade looked out across the Midwest and the forecast and said, hey, the rains didn't do as much damage, we don't think, as they had had the potential possibility to do. At least those have fallen already. And they look like they'll be scattered across the Midwest instead of widespread in the near term. And that is good news, at least for the growing crop, especially with the heat that's due to come in. December corn now, 288.5, the high, the low at 280.25, a settlement price at 283.25, down 3. It all means the crop should fare fairly well over the next couple of weeks, and that pushed the price lower. March corn, 293.25, the high, low at 285.75, the settlement price at 288.25, down 2.75. May corn now, 297.5, high, low at 290, settlement price there at 293, down 2.5 cents. And July futures, 298.25, the high, the low at 291. Settlement price, 293, down 2.5 cents. December corn for 2005, 269.75, the high, the low, and settlement price, they're both at 268. and they were down 2 on the day. July oats, 144 and 3/4. The high, the low at 140, settled 144 and a quarter. They were a penny lower for the day. From the soy complex, nearby beans were lower. The deferreds higher, 896. The high in the July is the low at 848, settled 863, 6.5 lower. August contract 817, high, low at 788. Settlement price at 794.5, down 6. November futures for the day, 675 the high, the low at 663. November is your new crop, 669, up a penny and a quarter. January's were 4 cents higher at 671. Settlement price there, 676 the high, the low at 667. And the May contract, 666 the high, the low at 655. Settlement price there at 659. They were up 5.5 cents on the day. July bean meal, 285.50 the high, the low at 274.50. Settled 280.70, up 120. And July bean oil, 27.80 the high, the low at 27.06. The settlement price at 27.24. They were down 12 for the day. Don't forget, coming up this afternoon at 6 after the hour, the closing market report and our special hour-long edition with our radio crop tour across the Midwest. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. It was a higher day today overall on the Mercantile Exchange. The one exception was July live cattle. August feeder cattle, let's start there. The high price, 110.20, the low, 109.10, the settlement, 109.62.5, that up 82.5. September, 107.70, the high, 106.80, the low, 107.60, the settlement, that up 80. October feeder cattle, 106.65, the high, 105.85, the low, 106.42.5, the settlement, that up 67.5. June live cattle, 86 even the high, 85 even the low, 85.70 the settlement, that up 70. July live cattle, 87 even the high, 86.60 the low, 86.90 the settlement, that down 50 cents. August live cattle, 87.10 the high, 86.10 the low, 86.65 the settlement, that up 72.5. July lean hog, 77.25 the high, 76.10 the low, 77.10 the settlement, that up 77.5. August, 76.10 the high, 75.15 the low, 76 even the settlement, that up 70. October lean hog, 64.40 the high, 63.70 the low, 64.35 the settlement, that up 32.5. December lean hogs, 59.50 the high, 58.75 the low, 59.47.5 the settlement, that up 45. And July pork bellies, 114 the high, 112.30 the low, 113.97.5 the settlement, that up 205. That's a look at prices from the Mercantile Exchange this afternoon following Ask Dr. Science. I was going to say Moment of Science. Following Ask Dr. Science, I'll tell you what's happening on Wall Street.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
A good one from Terrence Borix, Schenectady, New York. Dear Dr. Science, if the internet was built with my tax dollars, why must I pay to use it every month?
Any fees you pay for online access are actually donations to a fund to deprogram people brainwashed by nonstop browsing. In fact, there's a secret treatment center hidden in the brown, scrubby hills of Southern California dedicated to this problem. You'll end up